In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Have you ever noticed that the word pandemic is panic with a dem in the middle of it? Just a little observation there. Welcome, this is the iSpy Radio Show, where every week we bring you a little more intelligence on big government, and oh boy, are we seeing big government at work, shutting down huge elements of society all over something that we have very little real data about. But have you noticed how very few solutions are out there? When is the last time you heard something in the news about the coronavirus that actually calmed your nerves? You defeat fear through knowledge. Well, we have one for you, some good news. You likely didn't hear this in the mainstream media. There is already a vaccine for the coronavirus. Yes, earlier this week, we got word that a Pentagon-funded company already has the vaccine ready to go as soon as the FDA approves, and they can make up to 10 million doses in their plant alone. And the really amazing thing is they managed to develop this a mere 20 days after receiving the virus's genetic sequence. Clearly, this is not some incredible mutant disease that is going to wipe all of us out if they can develop a vaccine in only 20 days. But have you seen this? No. Not good news in the news, just more panic. In fact, I want to warn you, you'll soon have another round of media-induced panic coming your way as more test kits hit the market, and suddenly thousands or even tens of thousands of people will all suddenly have the virus. Oh my Lord, it's spreading exponentially. Folks, they've had it. They're just now giving it a label as confirmed, and that's the problem. People are panicking with very little information. They talk about the death rate, but there too is a problem. They know how many people died, that's the numerator, just to remind you about something from basic math, that's the number on top of the fraction. What is not known is how many make up the bottom, the denominator. They're dividing by how many confirmed cases, but the actual number of cases could be 2, 3, 5, or 10 times that. So instead of a 3% mortality, it could be 0.3 or even lower. But with all the media and Democrat fueled panic, there is another bit of good news I doubt you've heard. Johns Hopkins, which has that famous coronavirus map, has also said emphatically that America is ranked number one in the world to be able to deal with this. Plus, the other good news is there are some simple fixes for this to help you avoid getting it in the first place. It turns out the coronavirus itself is highly vulnerable to simple soap and hot water. The virus has this skin of fat that holds it together. Soap and water breaks down the fat, and the whole virus just collapses like a house of cards. You know, I have to say, I'm astounded how quickly and easily all of society, especially our leaders, have fallen into this panic over a virus that less than 0.2% of people have, and one that easily had a vaccine developed in less than 3 weeks. But just because you're not panicking, it doesn't mean that others won't. So we want to bring you some good information this week. Our guest today has a great newsletter about the coronavirus in which he said, "This is a time for clear thinking. This is a challenge. It may be a crisis, but it's also an opportunity to rebuild America, to reset your family and your finances." And we couldn't agree more. I'd like to welcome Kevin Freeman back to the show. Kevin is considered one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. He has his own show, The Economic War Room, which you can find on Blaze TV and other outlets as well. Kevin, it's great to talk to you again.
Great. Glad to be here.
Yeah, so there's a little bit of panic, I think, and certainly in the mainstream media, but so let's maybe get that out of the way. The stock market is off by about 20, 25% from its earlier high in the year. What would you say to people who are tempted to hit the panic button? Is it time to panic?
Well, number one, I wouldn't say panic. It is the fastest drop in the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500 from a peak in modern history, and really since they've been keeping statistics on the S&P 500. So I understand the temptation to panic. It's certainly understandable. Having said that, we have a pandemic, and this was just declared a pandemic by the World Health Organization.
Yes.
We have a pandemic every 25 to 30 years, and we always get through it. And if you go back and look, every time we've had one, the stock market is substantially higher than it was at the bottom during the pandemic.
Hmm. Well, what is driving this? Is it solely the coronavirus? Because when we've interviewed you in the past, there have been actual attacks on the market. Certainly that's what happened back in 2008. What would be the telltale signs if this was more than just simple buyer's remorse or a standard sell-off?
Well, one of the things that would be indicative of an attack, an economic warfare type attack, and we actually believe that's the case. I don't have any forensic data that anyone's hacked the market or is attempting to manipulate the market, although I understand that this would be a time to do it. If you were George Soros and you wanted to hurt President Trump, you would want to attack the market about now. In fact, just as a side road, George Soros mentioned a couple of months ago, the president shouldn't be elated that the stock market is hitting new all-time peaks because, it could be a peak now. And if it goes down later, for whatever reason, then that will hurt his chances of being reelected. And that's what, Bill Maher referenced something similar to that. There was a relish or a desire to see a market decline prior to the election. But I have no evidence that's taking place here. What we do know, and we do have evidence of, is that Vladimir Putin has literally begun an oil war, economic war with the Saudis. And that could be timed to impact the economy and could be timed to impact the election.
Well, certainly that was one of the big drivers there on, I think it was Monday, the impact of the Saudis and the Russia oil wars. And it was fascinating to see how that was beginning to play out. And we did hit some of those trigger points. And maybe you could walk our audience through a little bit of how what's going on now is different than what we saw back in 2008.
Well, in 2008, the financial system was in very poor shape generally and overall. Now, I would point out that we've actually increased the debt. The debt in the system is higher than it was in 2008. But the banks are in stronger position, and this is not a financial crisis, liquidity crisis. There's plenty of money around in the world. 2008, there was a liquidity crisis. And we've also faced in 2008, right before the election, much closer to the election, October, as opposed to here we are in March, we faced a run on the banks, and it was literally I did the work for the Pentagon. There were elements of financial terrorism and economic warfare in what happened to Lehman Brothers and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and so forth. Now we don't have any specific evidence of that. Now it seems to be a combination of panic over the virus, concern about the global economy, which is understandable. And then finally, this oil war that Saudi Arabia and Russia are ramping up production. And that is a threat to our shale industry, and so it's caused oil prices to drop precipitously.
Mm. Okay, let's go and take a break there. I'd like to continue that, how things are different now than in 2008. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more Kevin Freeman, one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, talking today about the coronavirus and the panic that's happening right now in the stock markets. We're doing that with Kevin Freeman. He is considered one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. He has his own show, Economic War Room, which you can find on Blaze TV and other outlets as well. And we'll certainly link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com. And also, I should really mention, you have a great newsletter. You call it the Economic Battle Plan, and you do this with every one of your episodes. Why don't you talk to our audience a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think we're the only show on television that has a battle plan. It recaps the episode and the guests that we've featured, if we had a guest. It then gives practical steps, things that we ought to be doing to address the challenge. And then it ends with a group of links that back up everything that we've said during the episode so that you can look up to see if it's fake news or real news. And it's real news. And I don't think anybody else produces it in a PDF document every week. I mean, if we sold this as a newsletter, it'd have value. We give it free to any viewers of Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman.
And we'll have a sample of that. It'll be Economic Battle Plan. It's from the economic impact of coronavirus. It was from back in February, right as all of this was beginning to hit. It's episode 76, and we'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com in our link section. And I'd like to continue talking a little bit about how things are different than last time. One of the safeguards that was built into the market after that 2008 crash was a trigger point. They kept calling it a circuit breaker on Varney & Company. It was designed to pause trading when the markets hit a threshold of being down by 7%. And as Stuart Varney explained, the pause is really designed to allow people to take a breath and kind of absorb the information. Talk to us about that design pause, and how does a 15-minute pause really affect people, or is it more designed to affect the computers so they can refigure and reassess?
Well, in my opinion, it is a very poor version of the uptick rule that used to be in place. From 1938 until 2007, there was a rule that the SEC mandated that said that you couldn't sell short if the last trade had been on a downtick, and that prevented this just mad rush of people to the exit or people trying to manipulate and take advantage of the situation. With the advent of computer trading, they abolished the uptick rule because it would stop the program traders in their tracks. There's no way that they could continue program trading if they had to verify that the previous tick in the market was an uptick, meaning that the stock had gone up on the last trade. So it would, by eliminating that, they opened the door for program trading. And then they realized that this blitzkrieg of selling could possibly create such a panic to take down the market. So they put in these circuit breakers. I wish they would go back to the uptick rule. I much preferred it.
What other kinds of safeguards do we have now that were not there after that 2008 market crash?
Well, the balance sheets of the banks are much better. We have rules against manipulation. We've learned about some of the things that happened with the flash crash that happened in 2010. But the reality of it is there can be a statement that goes on the internet, on Twitter, and it gets picked up, and the program traders, the algorithms, will begin mass selling. And that's what we're seeing happen this week. For example, when the World Health Organization declared it a pandemic, you saw an immediate rush down.
Yes, yes.
And that's not because people stopped and made a cogent decision. Oh, I need to sell. It was the program traders, and they were forcing selling. And then when the program traders see something the opposite, it causes these big gains. And I think it's detrimental to the system. It causes a loss of confidence when we have these, 2,000 points down, 1,000 points up, 1,200 points up, 900 points out. I do not think that's good for the system.
No, I don't either, because it really makes people very hesitant to get in. I mean, we had that big sell-off, and normally you might be tempted to say, well, there could be some real bargains out here, but then you have another wild swing like that, and you may have made a really critical error. How is this sell-off right now, you think, different than that 2008 sell-off? Is it driven primarily by computers right now, or is there something else going on? Or could it be simple matter that it's more of a correction because perhaps stocks were starting to reach that overvalued range?
Well, there's no question the stocks were a little bit high, but not necessarily massively overvalued. Up until January, the expectation was for continued economic growth, potentially a boom. What happened here is the fear that if we shut down the schools, shut down the hospital, shut down travel, stop going to restaurants, stop going shopping, that it's going to hurt the economy. But it'll be a temporary loss to the economy, with the exception of very small businesses that aren't prepared to weather that storm. But one other serious distinction between now and 2008 is that most people tend to buy index funds today. So they buy the S&P 500 instead of individual stocks. As a result, this creates a mass panic selling of everything, regardless of whether it should be sold or not. And so everything is getting hit at once. And then when people buy back, everything goes up at once. So that is a big distinction between now and 2008. And I think it's a dangerous distinction. But nevertheless, the underlying economy today, absent the short-term trigger we have, is much, much stronger.
Yes, yes. I think that's a very key point. Is so much of the fundamentals of this market right now, especially as we're beginning to see the impact of some of these trade deals come in. You've got the China deal that really hasn't even fully started. You've got the Japanese trade deal. You've got UK now that they want a trade deal. There is so much, I think, in terms of positive outlook that we just didn't have in 2008.
Absolutely. There's no question that the economy, the global economy, and particularly the American economy, is stronger because we've reduced regulation. We've done tax cuts. So we've cleaned up the corporations and what they pay relative to corporations around the world. But there is a threat that exists today that did not exist in 2008 to the same degree. And that is we have an extremely radical left that is pushing for socialism. And they've driven even Joe Biden, you know, Vice President Obama, who likes to hail himself a moderate, his agenda is so far to the left that I think that's a threat to the markets. If we panic here and were to elect a truly progressive administration, you know, that might be the worst possible outcome. It's much scarier than the effect of the virus. Mm-hmm. And so I did a blog on this titled Why Socialism is a Bigger Threat Than COVID-19.
Well, we'll certainly make sure that we link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Everyone stay with us. We'll take a little break here with Kevin Freeman. Coming back, we'll be talking some more about Russia and also what you can do to take practical, reasonable steps to protect yourself and your family in these times of uncertainty. Good information stops panic. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to Kevin Freeman. He is considered one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. His show is Economic War Room, which you can catch on Blaze TV and other outlets as well. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. And he's also generously joining us right now on his spring break, and we really appreciate that. This coronavirus thing, I think, has a lot of people, I think, rightfully concerned. And one of the things that was really driving the markets earlier in the week was the impact of the Saudi and Russia oil wars. The price of oil basically has hit rock bottom down into the 30s. And it really appears to be an attack on American shale producers. I know that you have an upcoming blog post on this. Why don't you talk to our audience a little bit about what's going on here?
Yeah, I mean, because the American shale industry has been so successful, we have literally defanged the ability of OPEC to raise prices and hurt our economy. It no longer exists as a risk. Because we can produce as much energy basically in the United States as we consume in the United States. And therefore, you know, if prices got to $60, $70, $80 a barrel, we would be net exporters of oil to the rest of the world. So we've become the swing producer in that respect. In 2014, the OPEC nations decided that they were going to conduct an oil war and try and drive our fracking industry out of business. And they did. They lowered prices dramatically. But we were more flexible than they expected, and we were able to continue to weather through that and produce oil. So what happened was Vladimir Putin, representing Russia, and the Saudis, representing OPEC, got together and they did production cuts. And so they were able to stabilize the oil markets, because if you get too low a price per barrel, Russia can't fund their economy and the Saudis can't fund their economy. So they tried to cut production. And that would allow for raised prices. Well, then we just kept producing more and more. And so with the COVID virus going around, with the slowdown of economic activity, they got together to try and do production cuts, and neither side would blink. And so they've literally, in this game of chicken, hit each other, and prices have dropped precipitously. And that caused a panic in the stock market because of fears that it represented a declining world economy.
Hmm. And what do you think is going to be the long-term impact here? Is this just, are we seeing sort of a short-term squabble between these two producers, or are they trying to gang up to attack American shale producers? What do you think the long-term impact here is?
Well, I don't believe they're trying to gang up at present. I think they're seeking out their own economic interests. But I do definitely believe that Putin decided to take advantage of the crisis. Hmm. And so he snubbed their nose. Putin really, truly believes that Russia can withstand pain much longer than the Saudis. And he probably is right. The Saudi budget depends on a much higher oil price than Russia does. Russia is in better fiscal position than Saudi Arabia is. And even though Russia's economy is dependent on oil and is reasonably weak, it is stronger, I think, better able to withstand lower prices for a little bit longer. So I think he's trying to force OPEC to blink, and right now neither side is blinking.
Well, what is he trying to do there with OPEC? Is he trying to, I mean, they're clearly not going to get out of the oil business. So what's his long-term plan there?
Well, Russia has been successful, and I'm looking at a Bloomberg report here. Russia's break-even price for oil in 2011, 12, and 13 was close to $100 a barrel. Right now, their break-even price is about $40 a barrel. So they're in a position that they can keep prices low longer. His goal is to get either the American shale industry, which is something he has hated. He hates American fracking. He has lobbied against it. He's funded spies against it. He is, you know, he hates it. So his goal is either to bankrupt some American shale companies or force the Saudis to take the production cuts. And he wins, in his opinion, he wins either way.
Well, it's interesting to where we are today versus in years past. I mean, the old oil shock used to be that we'd have this economic havoc from a spike in energy prices, and right now we're having an economic havoc from a decline in oil prices. I mean, it's amazing how the situation has changed here, especially because we're now a net exporter.
Yeah, absolutely. We are the swing producer, the largest producer of energy. We have the best technology. But the impact here from low prices is potentially against Texas and Oklahoma and North Dakota and those places which have really built our shale industry. So it is a risk to us and to our economy. If prices are too low, there are potential bankruptcies and so forth. Now, if there's a silver lining, it is that in the end, our economy is much less energy weighted than it was in the past, at least as measured by the S&P 500. So the impact to the stock market in the 1970s, if you cratered the energy industry, would have been dramatic. It's a much smaller component.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're based there in Texas. What are you hearing down there? Are people genuinely worried, or they realize this is just a short-term thing?
Well, you know, the solution to low oil prices is low oil prices, and the solution to high oil prices is high oil prices. That's the free market approach, because if prices get too low, then people consume more. The problem here is it's happened in the context of two things that are a risk. One is the coronavirus, which means global economic activity is lower. But the second one is the ESG movement, environmental, social, governance. Yes. And that is a movement of large pools of money to divest from fossil fuels and to invest in very left-leaning causes. And so the available pool of capital to support the energy industry has shrunk. And that's a threat. And that's, you know, again, socialism is a greater threat than COVID-19, and extreme, you know, irrational leftist approaches, which ESG in many cases represents, is a greater threat to our economy also.
Oh, absolutely. And we're seeing that here in Oregon. The treasurer is looking to make ESG a criteria when he invests state funds, although with him it's played a prop of unions, but that's another story. All right, let's go ahead and take a break there. We'll have more with Kevin Freeman coming up. We'll be talking about the effects of the coronavirus. Stay with us. Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Kevin Freeman. He's one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic and warfare and financial terrorism, and a lot of economic things going on this week for sure with the coronavirus, oil wars between Saudi and Russia, and now with the World Health Organization declaring coronavirus a pandemic, which is also now driving the stock markets. And Kevin, just to follow up from last segment there, you're talking about ESG. This is kind of a new, investing philosophy, especially on the left, wanting to put their money into companies that share their values. Social justice warrior mentality for investors, I suppose. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance. This is something our own treasurer here in Oregon is pushing, investing our money into companies that share his leftist values rather than into companies that generate the highest rate of return for Oregonians. Why don't you talk to our audience a little bit more about all of this?
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, because this is one of the greatest threats to the investment market sanity that I can think of. Essentially, ESG, I have no problem with the idea I want to be socially responsible with my investing. The problem I have with ESG is, number one, nobody knows exactly what it means, and therefore those who are managing the money get to determine it. Environmental, social justice, governance. Larry Fink, who's the CEO of the largest investment firm in the world, BlackRock, which has $7.4 trillion of money, recently came out and said, we're no longer going to make our top priority being to get the best returns for our clients. Instead, for sustainability, we've got to adopt this ESG approach, which creates the risk of a slush fund for managers who can divert money to any social justice cause that they deem appropriate. And the people who have the money have no say in how that's being done.
Wow.
It's very frightening.
That's exceptionally frightening. And now, you know, like, as I mentioned here in Oregon, they're doing this. Tobias Reed, our treasurer, is looking at making this part of their investment strategies. He's supposed to be having the highest return on our investments. That's his job as a treasurer. But if they're doing this, I mean, that to me, that's a violation of his fiduciary responsibility. Plus, you're having the government just make these decisions as to what's, you know, social justice or whatever, not individual investors. As you say, you know, if you want to make, say, environmental issues a key part of your investment strategies, that's fine. But it shouldn't be the government deciding what actually qualifies as environmental, social justice, or whatnot.
Well, I agree with that statement. But here's the problem: is the government's not actually deciding. What it is the investment manager is deciding, and the investment manager says, you know what? I'm going to demand that you, corporation, stop using coal or fossil fuels or any other thing that might be viewed as objectionable. Stop using it, or we will divest you. We will sell. This is getting into crazy town because we are no longer the people who own the money, the actual investors, and it's their pension money, have no say in how that's being invested. So we've created an alternative. We call it LSV. Liberty, security, and values. We think the average person might prefer those things that support personal and economic liberty for our nation, security, which would be national security, personal security, cybersecurity, and values, Judeo-Christian Western civilization values. Given a choice, we think most people would pick LSV over ESG, and yet you're not getting a choice. The managers are deciding to go that direction in large part. I have no problem with young people if they say, hey, look, I want my money invested in ESG, and they pick an ESG fund. My problem there is that how do they know that the manager is actually fulfilling their wishes? They don't. There's no standards. None.
Well, in terms of things like you had mentioned, I guess it was off the air when we were talking about this, but the governance of things, like where, for example, they want so many women on a board. But, I mean, it really begins to be a slippery slope because maybe they need to have a transgender on there, or maybe, you know, someone from the LGBTQ crowd, or and so on. But they may not have the same experience or be as qualified as somebody else, but they're pushing that on as part of the governance of those boards. I see that.
Let me comment on that.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Absolutely. What the mandate is, if California's retirement system invests in a company, they're mandating that company have at least one woman on the board of directors, which I think is a laudable goal. I do think there's some value in gender diversity, and I think it should be encouraged. But that's the old setup. They've talked about now, if there's five directors, at least two of them have to be women. Now I'm beginning to question, does that mean you're getting the most qualified directors? And then the next thing is, if you have three or more, or six or more, you have to have at least three women. And they said this is the first step in gender diversity, meaning that, you know, there's all these labels. Whatever you believe socially about gender and gender fluidity or all of those other things, I don't think it's rational to say that we have to have a representation on every board of directors of every gender, you know, possible. If you limit it to two genders, then maybe it makes sense. If you say there's 29 genders or 700 genders, it doesn't make sense because you've got to have the most qualified people on the board. Now, here's the thing that bothers me the absolute most about this is the same managers that are mandating ESG here in the United States are also heavily investing in China. Not all of them, but Larry Fink and BlackRock has said our biggest growth area is going to be China. Now tell me, how is China good with environment? How is China good with social justice? How is China good in corporate governance? They're bad in all three areas, at least for American investors and from an American perspective. And so I think the hypocrisy is just incredible. This is one of the underlying things that I think is going on behind the markets. People are afraid, wow, things are getting really upset. And especially if we see a removal of President Trump, I think that's a threat to the markets.
Oh, absolutely. Well, it's crazy that they're pushing China at a time like this when I think the world is seeing that it was really pretty crazy to be putting all of our investment eggs into China's basket there. But you know, this whole environmental, social justice, governance, ESG, this is the kind of stuff that I think that used to drive Milton Friedman just nuts back in the 70s and 80s when he would say a company's social function is to make money for its investors, period. If the people who work for that company want to go do social or environmental causes, you know, go right ahead. But the company is there to return a profit for investors. But now people, well, for example, the environmental crowd went after Walmart big time and pushed them to spend millions and millions of dollars on environmental causes while also saying Walmart doesn't spend enough on or doesn't pay its workers enough. I just think this is crazy what we're doing here in terms of free markets.
They're afraid that the average American, if they got the owner of Walmart, the good people on Main Street, got their dividend check from Walmart, they're afraid that they wouldn't spend the money the way they want it spent. They're afraid that they would not support the causes that they feel must be caused. This is a difference between individual liberty and collectivism.
Right,
and so
right.
ESG is just a form of collectivism trying to force their views on the globe.
Hmm. How horrible that people would actually make money and then be able to spend it the way that they would like to. All right, well, we didn't quite get around to coronavirus. We'll do that next. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're having a great discussion here with Kevin Friedman. He is considered one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. He has his own show, Economic War Room, which you can find on Blaze TV and other outlets as well. We'll link all of that up on iSpyReader.com. It also has a great newsletter, although they call it the Economic Battle Plan. It's a wrap-up of each one of the shows and includes a whole bunch of links and stuff, and we'll have a copy of that also on today's show page on iSpyReader.com. And Kevin, so this coronavirus, a lot of our discussion here, I think, is going to come from that that PDF that I just mentioned. This is for episode 76. And the coronavirus, I think, has a lot of people scared, at least in the mainstream media. I think most people quite aren't doing the freak out that the mainstream media is. But as you point out, there are some second order effects to continue to consider with coronavirus. And among them, you mentioned economic effects, also market effects and health and political. So why don't we walk through some of these? One of the things that you mentioned is that the Chinese economy has really ground to a halt right now. They are starting to ramp up production again in some cities. But you, in your newsletter, say that the Chinese government estimates that economic growth will fall to 4%, well below the original prediction of 6% for the quarter. Really, I look at that and I say, thank goodness we are where we are here in America, economically speaking. Can you imagine what this would have been like if Hillary had won and we would have continued Obama's lagging economy?
Oh, my goodness. One of the things that President Trump has done that's been very helpful for this is the fact that he pointed out how much of our supply chain is dependent on China. And with his trade war that a lot of people blamed him for, he has literally made us aware that we need alternative suppliers. Had we been solely dependent on China at this point, which is where I believe that the Clinton administration would have taken us, our economy would be well into recession already right now.
Oh,
because China shut down, literally shut down.
Yeah, absolutely. I was on another radio show as a guest, and I was saying that, you know, thank goodness Trump has done what he's done with that trade war, because as you say, it began to wake people up. I think we're about 6 to 9 months ahead of where we would have been otherwise, because people began to see, you know, this maybe isn't the best idea to have our entire supply chain routed through China. So I'm very thankful that Trump did all of that. One of the other second level effects that you talk about with the coronavirus is on the market. And you say the corrections are normal and a 13% decline is not unheard of, even though this was the fastest drop of 10% or more following a record high. And I think now we're down about 23% or so last time I looked. And you say this, investors will no doubt be mindful of which companies may be impacted more than others. In these circumstances, there may be advantages to owning individual stocks or industry ETFs rather than a simple index fund. And this is an obvious opportunity to check with your financial advisors. So what are some likely areas here, though, of opportunities for investors?
Well, you know, I used to work for John Templeton. He was one of the greatest investors of all time. He was a true pioneer in the mutual fund industry. He was a true pioneer in international investing. And he always used to say to buy when others are despondently selling and to sell when others are greedily buying requires fortitude, but pays the greatest potential reward. Now, I met John Templeton on the heels of the 1987 stock market crash. First time I met him. And he went on Wall Street Week with Lou Rukeyser, which was the CNBC of the day, and it only came out once a week on Friday evenings. And he said, this is a good time to buy and diversify. Well, I'll tell you, if you bought in that panic and the Dow dropped from 2,700 to 1,700 in about of 2 months, and we were at 29,000, so let's say we dropped to 19,000, which is far below where we are today. He said, it's a great buying opportunity. People were panicked. They were afraid to buy. Areas you might look at are the areas, he would say, the areas that have been the most beat up, and that would be energy stocks have been beat up, travel and leisure stocks have been beat up, or restaurant stocks and so forth. I'm not recommending any of that. I can't go on your radio program and make recommendations about investments. I can just talk in theory and terms like that just because I don't know your listeners to know their situation.
Sure.
But you ought to talk to your advisor about those areas most beat up and see if there are some opportunities there. One of the areas that's done well, better than others, is gold because people see gold as a safe haven. And then you might look at some of the technology companies that deal with virus and pandemics and so forth that can help respond. You know, there's companies that can help you work from home. So all of those are ideas that I've heard floated by others on other programs. And I just mentioned them as ideas to consider and look at, but not recommending anything individually.
Sure. And just the typical disclaimer, we're not recommending stocks. You really do need to consult your own advisor on that. One of the other impacts that you mentioned is health in addition to coronavirus. For example, that there may be limited supplies and possible shortages of gloves, gowns, and masks. We're certainly already seeing that. And again, most of those are made in China. One of the areas that you mentioned that I think could see an uptick, and this would be telemedicine. And when I was reading your newsletter, that was immediately what popped in my head even before I got to that other paragraph. And I see that this could maybe, this could really radically change how we interact, certainly with our own doctors.
Absolutely, at least for the short term. And I think, you know, people will find ways around the problem and so forth. But telemedicine is going to be an increasing part of our lives. It's less expensive to provide if you have. So one of the recommendations we made on our show was that you may want to go get one of those monitors that measures your oxygen levels in your blood. You just stick it on your finger and it'll measure the oxygen levels in your blood. That's a piece of information that a doctor diagnosing you might want to have. And so having some of those items at home would be beneficial. And maybe the telemedicine stocks will do well. They've done well, reasonably well so far. Maybe they will be good choices. But that's an area. One other area that we didn't get into heavily, though, is the fact that most of our medicines have a Chinese component, and we have outsourced so much of the active pharmaceutical ingredient. We had Rosemary Gibson on our program 2 years ago warning about this. And I had the privilege of introducing her to Frank Gaffney and to Fred Flights, who was at the time at the National Security Council and other places. And I can tell you, I'm very pleased to report that Rosemary's been talking at the highest levels in government about restarting those industries, the active pharmaceutical ingredient manufacturing industries here in the United States, and getting our supply chain for our critical medicines brought back to America. And we played a role in that in the economic war room, and I'm really proud of that.
Well, and I think that's something that we're going to see on the other side of this. And of course, you know, again, you got to get away from the panic notion here and begin to look further down the road than and after this all ends. I really think this is going to be a great opportunity here for a lot of manufacturing in the U.S. You mentioned the drug components. Why aren't we doing that here in the U.S.? You would think that that's something in terms of quality control and everything else. I think that's a real opportunity here for U.S. companies to again start manufacturing drugs here in the U.S.
out of this crisis, many good things can emerge.
Yes.
And I believe they will if we stay the course, if we don't panic. There's a Bible verse, 2 Timothy 1:7, I believe. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind. And if we operate in a position of strength, if we demonstrate love to our fellow human beings, and we use rational approaches to this, we can get through this and make it a good thing for America in the long run.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are some tremendous opportunities here. In fact, I would like to talk about that in the very next segment. Everyone stay with us. We'll have more with Kevin Freeman. And welcome back in our final segment now with Kevin Freeman. He's considered one of the world's leading experts on the issues of economic warfare and financial terrorism. His show is The Economic War Room, which you can find on Blaze TV and other outlets as well. We'll make sure we link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com. And Kevin, in this last segment, I'd really like to talk about some of Trump's responses to Corona and the market and just some real opportunities here, I think, that are in front of us. And get away from this doom and gloom that we hear so much on standard mainstream media. One of the things that I think has been really fascinating to watch is how Trump has responded to all this. It's almost like the guy's got a crystal ball or something. You know, we mentioned earlier about how he has begun months ago to transition us away from having so much of our supply chain in China. And, you know, he started shutting down the border. All of these things, I think if Trump hadn't been in office, I think we'd be in far worse shape than we are now. And one of the things that I noticed, the very first thing that he said when the Fed started to cut its rates, he said, this is a great opportunity to start refinancing some of the debt. I just love his mindset, is always seeing that opportunity there.
Yeah, the president has a lot of positives in a crisis like this. One of them that I heard a friend of mine who used to be the head of investment strategist for Wells Fargo, chief investment officer at Wells Fargo, he said, you know, it's great to have a germaphobe in the White House because he's cleaned up the White House. He hasn't wanted people, you know, touching and all sorts of things. And I think that's a positive. And I think he's doing that positive here. But beyond that, in a real true sense, the idea that you can borrow money for 30 years for 1% or less, and it's the first time in history that I think every aspect of the yield curve has been 1%. Why shouldn't we be borrowing 100-year money for infrastructure at a very low interest rate and spending that would boost our economy? It would position us well for the long run. And if you mm-hmm. borrow at that long-term time frame, it's not going to hit our budget the same as, you know, if interest rates went to 5%, if we borrowed it 100 years, it wouldn't matter because that money would be spent and it would be a 100-year time frame. And we'd certainly get a payback on that infrastructure. So there are good things that can come from this.
Oh, absolutely. I think there's a ton of them. Another one that he mentioned was he's going to look at doing a middle-class payroll tax cut. He had kind of floated that idea a few months ago, and it was in the middle of the impeachment hearings and all that, and you just couldn't see them happening. And now with the coronavirus epidemic that people are so concerned about, and companies are saying they'd like to have people working from home and what, I don't see how the Dems can say no to that. I think that would be great is to force through that payroll tax cut right before the election.
Yeah, well, I think that is a high probability that we'll see some sort of fiscal stimulus, whether it's a payroll tax cut or whatever. In Hong Kong, in their response to the virus, they just literally handed out money. Mm. Excuse me. They gave money to every citizen. One better way is to let people keep their own money, which would be a payroll tax cut.
Yes, and then the nice thing is on the other side of that, suddenly they're not going to want to give that back either. They get adjusted to those tax cuts, and suddenly they like having their own money. One of the things, too, that we've talked about, too, is this genuine change in our supply chain. You had in your newsletter, you had mentioned that Peter Navarre was on Fox News, said that we've offshored so much of our supply chain, not just for Corona, but also for essential medicines that we need. And we need to start pulling all of that back. And the question is, though, is how much do you think the coronavirus scare could lead to an actual permanent change in America's supply chain and a shift away from China? And if so, to what extent and where will that go? Will it be here in U.S. or just other countries?
I absolutely think it will be a permanent change in this respect. No decent CEO will ever again put all of his eggs for a supply basis into China. You'll have
imagine.
To look for alternatives.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it won't be just the U.S. or people will be looking to Vietnam or Mexico or Canada or whatever. I think it'll be good for global trade. China had gamed the system, and the world is paying the price.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, too, with this big sell-off, I think there's going to be some real buying opportunities. Again, we're not giving investment advice, but are there some industries in particular that you might see a big rebound? I know that you had mentioned some of the ones that have been hardest hit. Those might be ones to look at. But are there other ones beyond that?
Well, anything that's manufacturing here in America is a positive. We've heard of people restarting companies that will manufacture the masks that are used in industry and hospitals and so forth. Anything dealing with medical equipment potentially has opportunity, because if this virus continues to expand across this country, you know, up tenfold in a week, basically, if it does that until it peters out, we're going to need more hospital supplies and beds and things like that. And so there'll be a rush to move that manufacturing back to the United States. And I think that'll create opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. I like in your newsletter, too, that you say this is not a time to try to get rich quick. I think that people could put themselves in a vulnerable position if they tried to do that. Certainly talk to your advisors. You also mentioned what should people be doing. The big thing is, of course, don't be fearful, but also really focus on prevention and treatment and stock up. And I think that's a really important point, because just because you're not panicking, it doesn't mean that others won't. Or you'll see governments like New York State, which took preemptive measures, locking up New Rochelle, essentially, where in their best socialist communist style, they've quarantined an entire area. What are some other things that you think people should be doing?
Well, one of the things that I did for my family was we went and got a 2 to 3 weeks supply of food that we could get by on, and not because we expect there to be a problem and not certainly to cause a shortage, but just it's prudent. The Bible says twice in Proverbs, a prudent man sees danger coming and he prepares for it. And so you have you get an extra 2 weeks to a month supply of medicines and so forth. You don't need to fill your garage with toilet paper. You don't need to fill your garage with canned goods, but have just a couple of weeks. And we ought to do that anyway, under any circumstances, because
Absolutely.
A tornado could hit or other natural disaster or whatever. It's just prudent. And so people should just act prudently.
Yes, great advice. And there is plenty more great advice in his economic battle plan. We'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Kevin, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Well, thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk to iSpy Radio.
That is all of our time for today. We certainly hope you're at least a little wiser and calmer for having been here. Remember the good news. There is already a vaccine developed in a mere 20 days after getting the genetic sequence. Clearly, the coronavirus is not some mutant, humanity-killing virus if they can develop a vaccine that fast. Lots of good links on today's iSpy Radio show page. Good news, useful links, and lots more. Check those out and share them with your family and friends to calm them down. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.